welcome back, Wizards, to another episode of the Wizard Factory podcast, where you subscribe to weekly videos exploring deeper knowledge of the universe and yourself. My name is Logan Hart.
And I'm Brian Easterday.
And we're joined today by Daniel Cuellar, who is the founder of Peaceful Anarchism and the Peaceful Anarchism Facebook page. And he also produces many YouTube videos as well as DTube. He's a practitioner of Eastern healing arts with degrees in acupuncture and Chinese medicinal herbs. And he is a very outspoken anarchist who is also a avid chess player, philosopher, comedian, and now father of two little anarchists. And yeah, we're very honored to have you on the show. Welcome, Daniel.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Excited and looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, so we're very excited to have you.
So I think a good place to start this interview is on the topic of conscious parenting, because personally, I think that this is one of the most important yet undervalued components of just building an all-around good world, a good society, you know. So how did you get interested in this topic?
So before I had we had our first child in 2010, I had no idea what peaceful parenting was, and actually I remember having a conversation with my wife at the time before she was pregnant, and I said, so if our child is out of line or misbehaves, we're gonna hit him, right? And she's like, yeah, makes sense. And so I kind of never gave it a second thought. And also, actually, interestingly enough, before having kids, I would see, school buses come, and we would reminisce, like, oh, our child's going to be on the school bus one day.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny how radically we've shifted, and how, how before becoming a parent, you really don't know how you will parent. You know, you really only know once you become a parent. So it's amazing how that shifts. It's like once it's your child, once it's your flesh and blood, and you have skin in the game, then things change. You know, you begin to reexamine some things, and I did anyway. And so we had the child, and that's when I started really educating myself. I found Stefan Molyneux, Peaceful Parenting videos, and I was introduced through him about the other things, economics, free markets, philosophy, anarchism, voluntarism, capitalism. And then I, found other things, Larkin Rose and, Lou Rockwell and Tom Woods and all that. But yeah, Stefan Molyneux really influenced me about peaceful parenting, and I took it to heart, and it just made sense to me. And, I mean, my childhood, I wouldn't say was a violent childhood. I mean, my parents did, physically hit me occasionally, not a lot as maybe other people. And I mean, my wife had a slightly more authoritarian upbringing. You know, she grew up in communist Romania. She was born in 82, and she came here in 94 to New York. And so she witnessed communism falling in 89. And yeah, it's amazing to hear her upbringing, how she came, how she grew up there, as compared to mine, growing up in Rockland County, New York, as compared to communist Romania. Big difference, right, in terms of parenting. And, we tell our kids all the time, right, now my kids are now 7 and 9, 7-year-old girl, 9-year-old boy. And we tell them all the time that, opportunities that you have available to you right now, especially because you're homeschooled. that's especially, but also the fact that, we are consciously peaceful parenting. We don't spank, we don't, punish, really. And we, I try to reason with my kids, I explain things, and I try to talk down to them. I encourage their questions. I actually love the idea of paying kids instead of like giving allowance, you know, that maybe most of us, I don't know, I think I got allowance for doing nothing every week. I don't know if you guys did, but I didn't like that. I don't like that idea because it's like just giving them money for nothing, right? And so
it's breeding that entitlement.
Yeah.
Just like, pay me.
You could say that, yeah. And so if we were going to give them money, might as well have them work for it and earn it, right? So they've been working for me, helping me teach my chess classes for the past, I'd say since last year, maybe like in the fall. Yeah, maybe in the fall since last year. And I tell them if they do a good job in helping me teach the kids and if they're professional and if they, you know, sometimes my kids get crazy in my chess classes and I say, well, if you help me control them, help me manage them and don't contribute to the craziness, you know, you be a professional, I'll pay you $5 per class. That's why I pay them $5 per class for each of them. And it's very lucrative for them. and they love it. and I love telling people that I support child labor. Because it instills professionalism, work ethic, you know, learning right. How to please customers, and just understanding that it doesn't have to be money, but just value is derived from work. You know, we create value through our actions, right?
Yes.
And so to just give children something, especially money, for nothing,
they won't value it.
Yeah, they won't value it, and they're going to grow up, and eventually, you know, they will work. And so why not get them used to that idea of having to work for their money? So yeah, I definitely incorporate that into it. And peaceful parenting. I mean, I have a lot of videos on peaceful parenting, a lot of posts I do, a lot of writing, my blog posts, my articles on peaceful parenting. It's really a big part of what I do. I talk about that a lot, and, you know, anti-circumcision and all this stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it really is such an important area to focus on that I think, you know, a lot of people kind of overlook, but it's, you know, so much of our society and, you know, the behavior people like toxic behavior people have as adults comes from a place of being traumatized as a child. So bringing that conscious parenting, you know, is so much better for society as a whole. Like if you can have a generation of children who are raised to be aware and to actually understand, right from wrong and, you know, how to actually work for things to create value. That's going to create a lot of change in the world, you know, and that's really the only way to go about it. It's a lot easier to teach children the right way than to try to undo a lot of programming that adults already have ingrained in them, especially if they're, you know, a lot older. They've been set in their ways for a long time. There's a lot more ego in the way that you have to get past where the children are like a sponge. They want to learn. They want to know how to do things. So if we really, you know, take the time to understand, especially in those formative years, those first 7 years of, you know, laying a proper programming in there for children that actually know how to think for themselves and they want to question. They don't see learning as a punishment or something that's forced on them, but rather something that's part of life and it's enjoyable to do. That's how you create, you know, people who understand freedom and will actually want to learn and question and, you know, make the changes in society that we would all like to see happen to create a freer world.
Right. Very well said. I love, Danilo, that you brought up a few of those things. We've actually done an episode on some of these topics called the Healing the Wounded Warrior that touches on spanking and circumcision. But we're very happy to revisit these things because it is very, very important. And, you know, I think things like spanking can really lead to, like, pave the way for so many other problems that come forth in the aggregate sort of psychic weather and how things are playing out, because it's all coming back to what I would label as flat out trauma-based mind control. Spanking is trauma-based mind control. And then that is going to play out in unconscious ways, and especially things like accepting the gaslighting that is statism, that we're just these reckless animals, that we need to be controlled and governed and forced into obedience. Otherwise, we would destroy ourselves and all this kind of thing. So, I think that's just fundamentally important to continue to revisit all of the things that we sort of take for granted or just accept as normal or just the way things are done, and really take a look at what it actually is doing and what is playing out because of it.
Yeah, yeah. Going along circumcision is piercing the ears of girls when they're babies, right? Before they can consent, right? And so that's something we didn't do with our daughter either. And what's interesting is that my daughter is very strong girl. You know, she doesn't shy away from difficult situations or pain or something that's hard. She does a lot of things like ballet, tap dance, and gymnastics, and she's very athletic. She's very strong, and she's very good at chess. Also, they both play chess, and they're both pretty equal, even though she's 2 years younger, which is pretty amazing. But one thing that she wanted early, I think she was 6 years old, is her ears pierced. She really wanted her ears pierced badly, right? And I was like, are you sure you want this? it's painful, it's not comfortable. She's like, yes, I want it. And so we went to an ear piercing place, at a tattoo parlor, and they did it there. And he did one side, and it was very painful. It was painful enough that she started to cry, right? She started tearing. And I'm like, all right, we don't have to do the other one. It's okay. And she's like, no, I want the other one.
Wow.
So that's, it's amazing, you know? So I was amazed at her fortitude or determination in doing something. Once she sets her mind to it, like, there's no going back. She wants to do it. And
yeah,
so I'm proud of her. Yeah, good.
That kind of brings up something, with the way children are wired, it's very impressive to hear that a child that young is understanding the concept of sacrifice or delayed gratification, because that's essentially what that comes down to. Is she knows that in her mind, the temporary pain is not outweighed by the long lasting satisfaction of having her ears pierced. So that's really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's like that in a lot of ways, you know. Like in gymnastics, she excels in a lot of things. You know, she did gymnastics and ballet since she was 3 years old, and she's really good in both of them. She's like competing in ballet right now. She's competing in modern dance and jazz since last year, 2019, when she was six. And she's very good. And people, my friends, like, I say she's very good because, you know, it sounds like I'm being biased, but other people, when they see her dance with another group of girls that are similar age, they're like, wow, she's very good. She's like on point, and she's into it, and she's not afraid of being on stage. Whereas the other girls are more like, you know, hesitant, reluctant. They're looking at the teacher for like the moves, and they're also shy on stage. But my daughter's like out there. It's just amazing. She's undaunted. And she enjoys the hard work. So, and you know, with chess too, she got really good because my son was better than her for a while, and then she decided that she wanted to get good. So she kept asking him, let's play. Even though she was losing every single time, she was like, no, let's play again. And then finally she started winning, and now they're about equal. So yeah, it's amazing. And like, you know, she loves going to chess tournaments with me. My son is so different than her in that he doesn't exactly enjoy competition, like tournaments, and he says he doesn't want to play games where somebody loses, whereas she has no problem like Monopoly or chess or going to competitions. He loves that. And so they're very different personalities, you know, and it amazes me. And that's what, for me, what homeschooling can bring out in a child is, you can see their different personalities and you can cater to their different personalities, right? Mm-hmm. So it's also, and also as well, respecting their, personal desires of, pursuing that which they're interested in. Like, the fact that we're homeschooling allows us to do all these things. Whereas if they did go to government school, not only would they be robbed of the time that they're at school, but they'll also be robbed of the time when they get home to do homework. They have to do homework for school. So how much time does that actually leave for them to do what they actually want to do and at the same time spend time with family? You know, it's like so much time is robbed by the state and government school. So,
yeah. Right. Well, yeah, and it's, you know, I really like what you said there about, you know, homeschooling. You're able to really notice the different personalities in your children and then be able to cater to each one of those, you know, like I noticed with my son, you know, for example, like he's, as an astrologer, that's useful. That's one of the very first things I did, you know, was, you know, create his birth chart. And that's been really useful for me, in kind of gauging how he likes that. But, you know, he's a Virgo and his like favorite thing is to just, he likes to organize things all the time, like for fun. Like he'll take this little stack of toys and he'll take them like one by one and then stack them up over here. You know, and I'll have, right now he's really big into dinosaurs, you know, like he's always going around roaring around the house, but I'll have these little stacks of dinosaurs like all over, like on my desk or like in the pantry, you know, and they're just kind of randomly everywhere, but he doesn't really like it if you like he has a certain vision in his mind of a way he wants to organize it, doesn't right. like anyone messing that up. Logan's laughing because he's Virgo too. He understands. So, and I think this is the funniest thing, you know, so. You know, so I just kind of like let like, okay, yeah, I've got a couple dinosaurs on my desk. And I, you know, if he's wanting to just, he's just having fun organizing things and, you know, he's got a vision in his mind, but I just let him do that because I understand that's kind of his disposition and that's what he's going to enjoy doing. That's him learning how to develop those skills and that part of his personality. So I can just, you know, give a little more room and leeway there and just understand I'm going to have dinosaurs all over the house, you know?
Right. I was also laughing because I was imagining him seeing like this masterpiece, like, you know, like the beautiful mind thing. And then you just see like this total pile of chaos.
Yeah, like dad comes in and just messes it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I just think it's beautiful to dive into these topics because, and I love that we're getting into this. We haven't touched on this, as like in a focused way as much as I would like on this show because it's so, important. And what I mean by this is the principles of anarchism, voluntarism. And what I'm getting at here is that with an episode like this where we're speaking with Danilo and he's just a very well-rounded, intelligent, and heart-centered man that just wants the best for the world, for, you know, his family and everything. And that's really what I want to say is that is what freedom is. That's what anarchy is. It's not, you know, people with masks and Molotov cocktails. It's people that want to raise beautiful, intelligent, and productive children and you know, let industry thrive through free trade, free markets, and things like that. I mean, that's what, you know, growing your own food and sustainability and things like that. That's the picture that we're trying to paint of what it truly means.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, when I first created my website, peacefulanarchism.com, back in like 2014, 2013, my wife was very nervous about using the word anarchism in the title. And so that's why I was very intentional in putting peaceful anarchism, very important, you know, because when I tell people that, yeah, anarchism is peaceful and people don't understand, they get confused, you know, so it's amazing how, you know, the statism that we were all raised in has deeply inculcated this idea that anarchism is chaos and disorder. And it even is in, I think is in the dictionary, when you look up the word anarchy, it is one of the definitions, chaos and disorder.
Right.
And it's amazing how they have, you know, the associations of those two things are very deep. And so that's one of the things that we have to, you know, illuminate is no, it's not. It's, you know, basically what anarchists are just people that don't want rulers, you know, don't want masters. And then of course, they get confused with the idea, oh, so you don't like hierarchy. No. You know, like being the president of a chess club is different than being the president of the United States. It's a big difference,
yeah,
you know?
Indeed.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
when chess clubs can print their own money and they can wage violent wars against other chess clubs, okay, then you might have a case of comparing chess clubs to states. Mm-hmm. Until then, no, they're not the same thing.
Right. Hierarchies are a natural system of order that organizes things. The difference being is you can opt out if you want. If you don't like the chess club, or you don't like the way an architect is building his project, no one's forcing you. You know, that's the thing. You can opt out, as opposed to, you know, governments, taxes, governors, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I really have a fun time, talking to people about these concepts, because, there's so much misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And
false, like, assumptions.
Yeah. And the circles that I run in, the homeschooling, families that I run in, tend to be a lot of women who are Bernie supporters, Bernie Sanders supporters, and they love socialism, and you know, tend to be green, eco, environmentally friendly type people as well.
There is a lot of overlap with the anarchist mindset and then the sort of new agey kind of hippie-ish, you know, that it's a similar energy of just kind of like remove the structures of, you know, the patriarchy, if you will, that mentality. It's kind of similar, even though they're different.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Feminists as well. some feminists, some social justice warriors have crept into our groups, although they don't really, jive well with us. And so, yeah, they've left, but I've gotten into some pretty heated debates with some feminists. Even though I'm not the type of guy to start a conflict or start a debate. I don't like debating people. I just find that it's very unproductive. You know, it's like somebody is so passionate in what they believe and nothing I say will change them. So, mm-hmm. you know, better I educate people, you know, passively through my videos, through my podcast, also just through how I parent my kids, you know, and also I was telling Logan that I want to start a economics course based on the Tuttle Twins books. Are you familiar, Logan, with the Tuttle Twins books?
I'm not.
Connor Boyack, he's an anarchist, and he wrote, Free Market Guy, a Capitalist, and he wrote these Tuttle Twins books, tuttletwins.com, and they're basically children's books targeted for ages 5 to 10. Mm. And great illustrations, and so he hires someone for the illustrations, he writes the storyline, and so it's basically these Tuttle Twins, and they go through adventures, and it's all about educating kids about free markets, about spontaneous order, about capitalism, about, you know, what is statism, basically, what is morality, what is law, what is theft, and then he talks about central banking, the Federal Reserve, inflation, monetary creation, and then they talk about also entrepreneurship, business, economics, also government school versus homeschooling. So a lot of different topics, and they're wonderful, because there's really a dearth of information of this type of these type of concepts targeted to that age group, 5 to 10. You know, and so he found that there was a gap there, and so he filled it, and there's their wild success. You know, and it's not only in the homeschooling community he's a success, but it's in also kids going to government schools and parents who want to teach their kids these things, and so yeah, it's pretty amazing. And so I bought, you know, he made 10 books so far. Actually, no, he just released his 11th book, and I want to create courses, either in person or online, based on these books, and I've already done one discussion with a group of older kids. Like, the kids are like 7 to 10 years old boys, and it was wonderful discussion. You know, we were talking about, and I was very careful. Like, I didn't want to tell them what I think. I didn't want to give them the answers. I wanted them to arrive at them on their own, right? Mm-hmm. So I would ask them, what is government? What do you think the government is, right? What is the law? what do you think the law is, right? Mm-hmm. And we started talking about, what is morality? How do you know what's moral? How do you know what's right and wrong, right? Is it based on the law, or is it based on something else? You know? And then the idea of legality does not equal morality, right? So if it's illegal to rob or to assault or to kill, if the government one day says we're going to do away with that law, does that make it okay to rob, assault, and kill? And they say no. So then it doesn't come from the state, right? You know, this understanding of morality. And then I mentioned also Jim Crow laws as an obvious example of how what is legal is not necessarily moral at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it can never be used as a yardstick for morality. So it was a very productive conversation, a very great conversation. And when I do another one, I want to record it and start posting them on my YouTube channel, because I think they're so valuable conversations. That's awesome. to hear kids talk about this stuff, you know? So yeah, that's one of my goals right now.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea, you know, and that's the a great thing too, is I think a lot of parents, you know, they think their only option is to send their children to the public school system, you know, like, cause they might be busy, you know, with work or between jobs, you know, like raising a family these days is definitely not cheap by any means. And they don't actually realize how many resources are out there to actually help, homeschooling parents, or like different get-togethers with groups, or, you know, people like yourself who could be creating online courses that, you know, they could have access to that could help teach certain concepts. But I really think you being able to use the internet and utilize things like online courses, and that anarchists are taking the time to design education that actually teaches about freedom and, you know, how economics goes, you know, hand in hand with that. Those are really great resources that I think we'll see more and more of them continue to come out and be developed and grow as more people, you know, shift into finding those. I think we'll kind of see a lot more people moving away from the public school system, which, you know, we already do see to some extent, for sure. There are a lot of parents out there very interested in keeping their kids out of, you know, the public indoctrination camps, you know, for sure.
Hmm. So Danilo, obviously there's a very strong theme here going about, you know, conscious parenting and teaching kids those fundamental principles. What is your commentary on like the systemic breakdown of the family unit and what value that intrinsically has, and why the state would be threatened by that and seeking to erode?
Yeah, breakdown of the family unit. Yeah, I think that's one. One effect of government schools is to definitely break down the family unit, because it reminds me of a quote by Malcolm X, which is never let your enemy teach your children, right?
I just posted a meme with that like last week.
Awesome. Yeah, one of my favorites. And it makes sense, I've known people that said that they said I know all the stuff they teach in government school is garbage, but when they go to school and then they come home and then they tell me what they learned, and then I try to reverse all that and try to show them how it's all wrong. And I'm like, wow, that's very exhausting to do that. You got to do that every single day.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's like your kids come home with like a mess of like charger cables, and you have to just like untangle them all. Like, oh God, what is this?
Oh my God, I can't imagine doing that. That's such a burden to foist upon yourself. You know, So I just find it to be so much more convenient and beneficial for the kids to just, you know, just homeschool. And just it's not, by the way, it's not easy to homeschool, because one parent has to stay home with the kids and one parent has to work, so it's a single income situation, right? And it's not easy, it's hard, you know. I understand people who can't do it. They say because of financial reasons, But, you know, you make your choices in life for what you think is important. You prioritize for what mm-hmm. you think is important. And you make sacrifices, you know? Like, we have definitely sacrificed for our kids. You know, it's amazing how when we talk to people who don't have kids and you know, the things that they can do, you know, on a whim, you know, I don't know, go to the movies or go on to a, you know, go to vacation or whatever.
Take a nap.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's amazing what people can do, yeah, who don't have kids. You know, it's like an investment into the future. That's what you're doing. When you're raising kids, you're pouring resources into this child. And you want, you know, this child to grow up and be, you know, an intelligent and productive and compassionate, loving member of society, you know. And so it's definitely an investment for the future. So that's how we look at it. So, I mean, I try to help my wife with income and everything. I teach my chess classes, but it's definitely difficult. We've made difficult choices. And but you know, I don't think we would do anything different at this point. And yeah, so that's one way that, yeah, the family unit broken up. You know, another way would definitely be like welfare, you know, the welfare state, encouraging people to not stay together, right? It gives the wrong incentives to people, especially, you know, giving parents money to, you know, just for having kids, you know, like we live in an area where there's a lot of Hasidic Jews, right? And so they have a lot of kids and they take full advantage of the welfare state. They get money per child, right? A lot of money. And, I'm not really sure how exactly they do it because they have like a mother and father, so they're not like single income people. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're not poor either. Like you understand people on welfare, they're like living in maybe housing projects or the ghettos or, you know, really low income housing. These people don't do that, yet they get money. I'm sure it has to do something with their religion. They get money through the state per child. And I'm thinking, and then everybody's like resentful of the Hasidic Jews for like, you know, populating, expanding, taking over counties, taking over the board of education, you know, the schools, and, you know, because they're very like inclusive. They don't, exclusive, right? They don't allow people into their community. They're very tight knit. Mm-hmm. And I made a video, a short video rant about how it's not their fault. It's not the fault of the Hasidic Jews. You know, they're not the enemy. No, the enemy is the incentives that they are merely responding to. Right? If you give money to somebody, you know, free money to somebody just for having kids, guess what? You're going to have more kids. You know, people respond to incentives. You know, that's exactly why they say don't feed the animals in a park, right? The animals will come back and they will stop trying to fend for themselves, and they'll just expect free food, free stuff constantly. So people respond to incentives. So you can't blame the people for responding to the incentives, the perverted, distorted incentives that the state has erected.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, you know, it's good to that you noted that homeschooling can definitely be a difficult process for a lot of parents out there, because it does bring you down to that, or it can bring you down to that single income. But again, I think just like where it could help in the education of children and homeschooling, as well as using the internet and, you know, modern technologies and things we have as parents, you know, where, you know, there's a lot of people kind of moving into that digital nomad lifestyle. Well, that's really kind of what I've also been working on creating for myself, because it also allows me to stay home, you know, because I work from home, but I'm also the one that watches my son most of the time when, you know, because his mother, you know, she works at, you know, like UPS, you know, she has a regular job where she goes and works for someone else. So me being able to use the internet and work from home and do consultations allows me to still have my career and bring an income, but at the same time also be there to, you know, help with my son and everything. And he's not at the age that we're doing school. You know, he just turned two. So, you know, we're still in very early stages, but, you know, we're mostly playing all the time and stuff like that. But as he, you know, gets older, I definitely am working to have that established where I can, you know, make sure to do both things. So that, you know, that's, I think, something that we could, you know, see a lot of parents maybe moving towards those options, or, you know, are not even maybe even aware that those are the kind of options that you can do, that you can actually start building a career doing things online or whatever, that it allows you to be there with your children as well as get the work done that you need to for your career.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like, based on what you were saying, that it comes down to the education is sort of that the nucleus of that equation in terms of the erosion of the family unit, so that the kids are forced into school. You know, the government is manipulating the markets, making things expensive, gas prices, all this good stuff, so that both parents have to work, or it's a lot harder to only have one working. And then you have things like feminism, the ideology itself that, well, you know, okay, the husband could support, but I'm not going to let that happen just as a matter of principle. I'm going to work too because I have a vagina and, you know, I'm going to have to prove something. And then the state is indoctrinating your children. And then they're, you know, the next generation is that much more far removed. So you could kind of look at the opposite direction of that being the crux of society, and then community is like the next level, like the extension of that family is like the family's families. You know, there it's just more emergent layers of organization, voluntary, peaceful, mutually beneficial cooperation, which is just what everybody really wants to be doing if we could just be left the hell alone for once. But yeah, would you like to weigh in on kind of like the importance of community and other ways that even further strengthens this, you know, it takes a tribe to raise a child kind of idea?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, one thing that people have the misconception about homeschooling is that it's a solitary endeavor. You know, it's like you just throw your kid in a room, throw books at him, and lock the door. That's what homeschooling is. And I mean, I tell them, we're barely in the house. Like, we do a lot of things. We you know, I teach my chess classes. I take my daughter to gymnastics, to ballet, to dance, to my son does fencing. We go, we have play dates. We meet up with other families. We do a lot of stuff. Like, my kids wish that we would stay home more. They long to stay home more. So, you should make sure that you meet up and find other families that are doing, that are either homeschooling or just, you know, are critical of government schooling. Mm-hmm. Because if you try to do this alone, you will definitely be, you'll be run down, you'll be exhausted. It's not something you do on your own, homeschooling. You have to find a community, you have to find a tribe. I mean, I'm a volunteer, I'm an anarchist, I'm a free market capitalist. I can safely say that nobody in my group of people that we regularly hang out with fulfills all of those criteria.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I still can't hang out with them and be friends with them, you know? They're cool people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're, you know, generally anti-state, you know, not to the point of anarchism, but they're generally critical of the state. They're critical of public schooling, and they're all peaceful parents, and that's great. And, you know, we get along. I've been friends with these people for like 5 years now, right? We've been hanging out and we go camping together. So it's like, you know, we're a very close knit group of people. And, yeah. So, you know, you definitely don't have to find like carbon copies of yourself in terms of your belief systems. You know, it also creates great discussion, and they've learned about me, and I'm sure they've understood over time as I've talked about. I mean, I don't preach to them. I don't like try to convert them at all, you know, but they know where I stand on a lot of things. And, and slowly over time, they ask me questions and they've come to understand certain things. So I think just having them know me, will make them feel comfortable with terms like anarchism and capitalist,
right,
and volunteerism, you know, so, and the idea of privatizing everything, you know, they've slowly come to understand the value of those things, without me actually having to, you know, physically teach them, you know, and point out how wrong they are. No, that's not necessary. So Like, that's kind of how I approach things. You know, you just be a good person. You know, you be moral, you be compassionate, you be a humane person. You treat people with respect, with kindness, and guess what? They respect you, and they might respect your beliefs as well. You know, whatever your beliefs are. So yeah, okay, create a community.
Yeah, that's
so valuable. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that definitely was a striking realization at one point when I was kind of rethinking the whole schooling thing about how it's the antithesis to natural law, something we talk about a lot on this channel, where nature, the universe, reality is the teacher, and yet we take kids and put them in this sterilized white room that looks like a prison and take them out of life to try to teach them about life. It just makes absolutely no sense. But it does go even beyond the education aspect, because yes, you're kind of raising children together collectively, and you're learning to respect each other's beliefs and this kind of thing, but also there's more accountability in communities, which makes the police obsolete or, you know, not needed. And then you got bartering and trade, which is good for everyone. It's the more of that, and just mutually beneficial interaction is really what it's coming down to, that it's voluntary is always better. It's always more fruitful and productive for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. you know, I think another big issue of what we can see, especially now in like states like New York, a lot of parents that weren't looking at homeschooling before are now considering it, specifically in context to the vaccination issue of, you know, public schools, that not only is it now a forced education and control of the mind, but they're now, you know, then laying claim over, you know, the physical body, even more than just telling you that your children have to be here at this, you know, at this time for sure. You know, like, they already have that, but then it's, you know, getting into the realm of forced medical interventions. And I know that's a big area that is kind of pushing a lot of parents to then look at the homeschooling option. Would you like to get into that?
Oh yeah, definitely. That's been in the news lately a lot over here, where I am in New York and New Jersey. We live in New Jersey, but we're very close to New York and Rockland County. That's where I go. That's where our friends are. It's where a lot of my kids' classes are. And so since last year, June 13th, last year, 2019, that's when the religious exemption for vaccines was done away with in New York. And it caused a big outcry, big backlash from people. A lot of people protesting, you know, going to the Capitol, Albany, you know, online protesting everything. And then a couple of months later, they did away with the medical exemption for vaccines. So now there's, and this is for government and private schools. So now there's absolutely no way for you to send your kid to any school whatsoever without getting vaccinated. So now that has forced a large number of families to do homeschooling if they really, so it really, what it does is it tests the resolve of parents in how seriously they consider, or how seriously harmful they consider the idea of forced vaccinations. You know, if some parents are like, you know, yeah, I don't like it, you know, I'll do an exemption, but some parents are like, well, you know, look at the pros and cons, and you know, I want to work, I still want to work, and have my spouse work, so I value that, and so now you're going to get vaccinated, so you can still go to school, you know. So it's really tested people and how firmly they are principled in this idea. And so all of my friends, my close friends, they're like me in the sense that they don't vaccinate, and they're very strongly principled, and so they have all been forced, except one. One is she was already a homeschooler, but the other ones, they all sent their kids to private school, and then the law changed, and then they're forced to homeschool. So now we're all homeschooling since last year in September. My sister also, she wasn't vaccinating. By the way, my sister is not a volunteer, she's not an anarchist in any way, and she's not a homeschooler either, but she did not vaccinate, which is one thing that we did agree upon, and so she was put in that position of choosing, and so she chose to vaccinate her kids. You know, it was a very difficult decision for her. She was like crying a lot and just, you know, staying up worrying and all this stuff, but she did it, and it's very sad, and you know, my wife is getting very involved in it on Facebook and following different people like Del Bigtree, who are big into the you know, the anti-vaccination community, and so there were a bunch of protests, one happening in Trenton, which is the capital of New Jersey, and my wife wanted me to go, but you know, for the longest time, I don't really recommend protesting for people. I don't like the idea of protesting because, number one, it's like we're begging our masters for a longer leash.
Yes.
And number two, it's dangerous because a lot of violence tends to occur in when large groups of people get together that are very angry and emotional. You know, that's when you get police in riot gear and, you know, the big buses, prison buses, and people get thrown in there. It's just not a recipe for
it's not a peaceful recipe. Police in street clothes being provocateurs and actually turning people into violent ones, and then the other police come in and do the stormtrooper thing or whatever.
But, right.
Yeah, I mean, the whole vaccination thing is just, to me, just yet another example of a proof of the government believing that they own your body and they have the right to tell you what you can and can't do with it. And it just amazes me that people don't see how dangerous this is, that anything to do with, you know, like this coronavirus scare and you know, vaccinations, it's such a weak point, you could say, where they're trying to slip in and, you know, control people and be complete tyrants for the sake of public safety. It's just, it's so dangerous. And I wish people understood that the government has killed so many more people than any virus, even the bubonic plague. I mean, come on now, like, just look at statistics.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So,
If people understood statistics, they would never be afraid. Okay. They would never be afraid of anything that the media is trying to tell you to be afraid of. If people understood stuff like that. But what was I going to say? The coronavirus. Yeah. You know, I used to do stand-up comedy, and, I'm a big proponent of using comedy to convey difficult messages.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I love Bill Hicks. I love George Carlin. I love, what's the guy's name? Bill Burr. You know, there's a lot of comedians that state truths in a very, you know, unfiltered,
digestible.
Yeah, digestible, funny way. And that's awesome. That's great. I love that, you know. So when I talk about these things, you know, these concepts that we're talking about, when, you know, like capitalism and free markets and trade, I mean, they seem innocuous, but most people would recoil and think they're, like, you know, horrible and dangerous, and anarchism, you know, especially. But if we can convey these topics, and this is what I try to do, is convey them in a very, you know, in a lighthearted, humorous way. So when I post stuff on Facebook, you know, if I write something, you know, my writing is very serious. My writing is not humorous, but when I post a cartoon or a meme, I try to make it lighthearted and you know, something they can laugh at, like a cartoon. That's why I love cartoons, you know, especially political cartoons. So if we can convey these messages and get people to laugh at the same time, that's a success, right? So, like, with this coronavirus, I mean, anything you can think of with the state is founded in fear. That's the foundation of power, is fear, right?
Yeah.
So if we can get people to laugh at authority, at those in power, we've already stripped them of one of their most powerful tools of mind control, what you guys are saying. So like, for example, this coronavirus, massive fear-based propaganda, massive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I joke about it all the time with those around me, you know, people are like, you know, people are like coughing or something, and I'm like, did you just get back from China? Like,
right.
You know, like,
I've been cracking jokes with my Uber rides, because I've been driving Uber and stuff, and, you know, people are coming from Walmart and stuff, and I'm like, you know, like, everybody's having a party in the toilet paper section. I was like, you know, I'll bring the corona, you bring the virus. And they were like dying.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, you really hit the nail on the head there when you say that laughter really strips them of that power. I mean, if you're even thinking about it, you know, from a physiological level, there's fear is, you know, dealt with in the reptilian part of the brain, whereas, like, laughter, that's a lot higher of a brain function. So if you can get people to laugh, you're immediately bringing them out of that state of fear. You're bringing them into a higher state of awareness. And that's also it's such a useful tool to be able to transmute potentially difficult messages in a way that, like, as you were saying, is very digestible and even beyond that, enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Laughter is such a useful tool for observing the shadow, you know, not only in, like, our own life and personal shadow work, but, you know, looking at things in society in general. You know, I think that's why comedians have such an important kind of place in society. They're like that release valve for the shadow. Yeah,
they're alchemical wizards that are transmuting that fear into awareness and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, that higher vibration, like you said. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think comedians can be the unsung heroes because they provide that social commentary, but they have that weird sort of immunity, like the court jester that can make a joke that can topple mm-hmm. a kingdom, like you've said, Brian. Mm-hmm. They wield such power, like people like J.P. Sears too. I'm a big fan of.
Oh right, yeah, like
he's so good at framing things. He just destroys it. It's absolutely amazing. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I was just gonna mention about comedy. How you're right. It's so powerful. Alchemical wizard. I love that phrase. I love that. That's really great. And you know the idea of restricting speech right now, right?
Mm.
And restricting what people can say, especially comedians. And you know when so I used to do comedy, right? Stand up comedy in clubs in Manhattan and Long Island, and.
Wow.
And I loved being around comedians. It was such a wonderful opportunity, such a wonderful experience because, you know, it's like it being at a comedy club, it's like everybody's there for one reason, right? To laugh, to be entertained, you know? And it's awesome. I love it. And just being around comedians, like they laugh at each other so much, you know, like I remember being at this one comedy club and so the comedians that were not performing were in the back of the room. And then, you know, in front of us was the audience and then the comedian. And so we were watching our fellow comedians go up there and do their thing. And sometimes when a comedian bombs and the audience does not laugh, that's when comedians laugh. They laugh. They laugh at the comedian for bombing. It's the funniest thing. So we're like constantly, riffing and making fun of each other, which is great. I mean, it's just a wonderful atmosphere. And so this idea of restricting what comedians can say, you know, hate speech and that's so unfortunate because the role of a comedian is, you know, what makes something funny is pushing the envelope of an acceptable opinion. You know, if you can, only comedians can talk about something on the fringes of what we would consider taboo. And that's really what makes it funny. Like, if they say things that everybody considers acceptable, that's not funny. You know, that's not what comedy is.
Exactly.
You know, so once you begin to restrict the content of what comedians can say, you are destroying comedy. You're destroying, you know, free speech and what it means to be funny. And so it's so, so unfortunate. And it's really telling, actually, how the state tries to do that. And so to me, it may be indicative of the state's fear that comedy is actually, you know, disarming their power.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, yeah, it's a very powerful, you know, magical tool if you want to look at it from that perspective. And I would say that even beyond, if they're restricting free speech, even beyond just destroying comedy, that could be, it's destroying human consciousness. Like you were saying, comedians, where they dwell in the realm of the fringe, you know, you're pushing the edge, you're pushing the boundaries, you know, you're laughing at the shadow of society that everybody thinks about, but other people are too afraid to say that, you know, that's how you can really grow. Or even in, if people were too afraid to ever look at any of the issues or things like that, and then they just went ignored, that it would just keep us in a smaller and smaller box. If you have a comedian who's out there, who is then pushing those boundaries, that's then getting people to think of new perspectives or can, like you just talked about J.P. Sears, he's great at that. He pushes those boundaries. It's an expansion of human consciousness using the tool of humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, comedy humor to me is just truth with a twist. It's like you just kind of exaggerate it or push it a little bit out to the edge, and then it strikes a chord in such a way. It's so fascinating to think about that.
Yeah.
I think that's probably pretty good grounds we've covered here. You know, painting a very nice picture of what an actually truly free society could look like. It's not, you know, explosions and chaos and looting and whatnot. It's just people that want to be left alone so that they can thrive and prosper and grow their families and live in abundance. So quite the contrary to what the powers that be and the media and things like that would want you to believe about this. And it makes sense why such a thing would be a threat to the status quo. So, I think that regardless of what they're trying to do and all these antics that they're doing, we're just moving that direction, and there's really nothing that they can do to stop it. They can just try to delay the inevitable as much as they can, but there's no stopping the power of the human spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I tell people that, you know, when I tell them my YouTube channel, Peaceful Anarchism, and then they have this, you know, confused look on their faces about the word anarchism, then I say, look at me, okay? We're a homeschooling family. We're in a single income. I bring my kids to gymnastics, ballet, tap, dance, fencing. Do you really think that I want disorder and chaos in the world by me being an anarchist? Do you seriously think that? You know? like just look at my life, how I have structured my life. That doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense, you know, when you think about it like that. And I love the idea of there's this I guess it's like a syllogism, which is you know, if every person, if all human beings are good, then we don't need rulers. Rulers would be, you know, absurd or irrelevant, right? If all people are bad, then, you know, having a ruler wouldn't really change them at all, right? If a small amount of people were good and a large amount of people were bad, right, then the evil people would be attracted to positions of power to rule over the smaller people, or they can just dominate them through voting, right, and impose their will on them through the state. If a large group of people were bad and small people, oh, sorry, the other way, if a large group of people were good and a small group of people were bad, again, the evil people would be attracted to government to wield their evil over the large group of good people. So in either situation, the state only makes things worse.
Yes, that's a great way to tie that all together for sure. And I'm so thrilled that we are able to, you know, revisit these ideas and, again, put this in the minds of our audience, because it is so fundamentally important in that our central mission is self-empowerment, sovereignty, and you simply cannot have that with a violent, destructive institution called the state out there ruling people's lives. It cannot coexist. So thank you so much, Danilo, for joining us today. It's been a really awesome conversation, so there's nothing left to do but tell the people where they can find you and what you're up to.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the conversation as well. I really enjoyed it. So I'm on YouTube. Just type in Peaceful Anarchism. You should find me in the search bar. And then my podcast is also Peaceful Anarchism. Find that probably on any podcatcher app like Stitcher or iTunes or Apple Podcasts. I'm also on Steam It, on DLive. Well, actually, I don't really, or DTube, I think it's called, but I don't post there much because it's kind of got glitchy. What else? Yeah, I got a Patreon page, and people want to donate to my stuff. You know, I don't do as much interviews lately, but I still do the short 5 to 10 minute video rants on various topics. Lately, I did a couple of videos on space and how, because I went down to Florida with my family in September. We went to Disney for the first time. I'd never been to Disney ever. And, I mean, we only went to Disney because it was like a gift from my sister-in-law for my kids for their birthdays. And so that's the only reason we went. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to afford it because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
You know, going, you know, the plane ticket down there, you know, how much the ticket is just to get into Disney. And then if you want to buy anything extra, oh my God, so, so expensive. Yeah, but it was a very interesting experience, and what we also did while we were down there was go to Cape Canaveral and visit that place, and I never been there, and I was overwhelmed with all the statism and all the hero worship and military worship down there. Oh my God, it's amazing how, mm-hmm. how, and, you know, I guess I didn't realize it to the extent that I did when I went there, but yeah, the only people that were really considered seriously to be astronauts are people in the military, in the Marines, you know, in the Army, in the Air Force. And so, yes, I did a couple of videos on and how I thought the U.S. space program was a, you know, one giant boondoggle in military worship and, you know, only really exists because of nation states and their desire to wage war against one another. And, you know, and I'm sure it would happen, you know, I don't know how quickly it would have happened without the state. But if it was, if there's some way that it would be economically productive for entrepreneurs to you know, go into space and maybe try to colonize and explore other planets, it would have happened if you know, people like Elon Musk could find ways to make it profitable. But yeah, sorry for going on that rant. But yeah, that's what I've been talking about recently. So yeah, I'm all over. I'm still on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. And yeah,
we'll put all those links down there too as well.
Cool.
But, yeah, love it, man, love it. So that's all we have for you folks. Thank you guys so much for watching. If you're new here, hit that subscribe button. We'd really love to have you. And you know, hit the like button as well, help us pop up in the algorithms and all that good stuff. Check out our website, thewizardfactory.com. and until next week, be empowered, inspired, and encouraged.